I'm Warren Olney. The Boy Scouts of America will now allow openly gay members, but only till they reach the age of 18. We'll hear how last week's compromise reflects conflicts between religious groups, the values of corporate America, and the traditions of scouting itself. That's later on To the Point. First, this story. Despite predictions of a race so tight that the results might be delayed, the election was over by early on Wednesday morning. Councilman Eric Garcetti will be the next mayor of Los Angeles. Controller Wendy Gruhl will be out of a job. With me in the studio are the men who headed the winning and losing campaigns, Bill Carrick, senior strategist for Garcetti, John Shalman, who played the same role for Gruhl. Gentlemen, welcome to Which Way LA.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
You.
John Shalman, first to you. What went wrong?
Well, I mean, there were situations that we couldn't control in the primary. We had two candidates in the primary, Jan Perry and Kevin James, who were both attempting to make the runoff through obtaining the base vote that was Wendy Gruhl's. Kevin James, with the benefit of about $1 million in outside money from a Texas billionaire, came in and went directly into the Valley, directly into Republicans, a moderate base, which is vote we had hoped for and expected to get, went in and really did a very strong job of defining Wendy with Republicans as a Department of Water and Power union mayor. And of course, Jan Perry, the other woman in the race, directed her fire and her attacks on Wendy falsely and relentlessly for a month. And it was very difficult coming out of that primary with the race configured in that sort of way to get back up off the ground. And it was tough. And we you know, there's a lot of other things that I think we probably could have done better. But in the end, I think we ran a strong race, getting there, keeping it tight almost to the end. So I'm proud of my candidate.
Bill Carrick, how important was it to Eric Garcetti that base, the more moderate and Republican-oriented voters, this is a Democratic city, went for Eric Garcetti rather than Wendy Gruhl?
Well, Eric ended up winning Democrats, Independents, Republicans, Liberals, Conservatives, Moderates. I mean, almost every demographic group in the city or ideological group, with the exception of African Americans. So, in the end of the day, he had a pretty balanced coalition. I think the reality of what happened in the primary is it's been like all the other primaries I've been involved in L.A. mayor's races. There's people struggling to figure out what their coalition is, what their constituency is, how to put together enough votes to get in the runoff. And I think we focused on basically trying to build that coalition from, we had ideas of what it should be, but we tried to build a coalition from the east side to the west side of the city and to try to make significant inroads into the Valley, which we originally thought Wendy would do quite well in. And we focused a lot on that early on, how to become viable in the San Fernando Valley.
Why did you lose the black vote?
You know, I think she had a great experience working with Tom Bradley that she consistently and articulately talked about, and working with LA's best. And then I think she had several good endorsements that were great references from Mark Ridley Thomas to Maxine Waters. Of course, Magic Johnson, who was featured in their television ads, and also President Clinton. So I think she had a good, strong case she could make with those references to African-American voters.
John Shalman, Wendy Gruhl, your candidate, published a lengthy document about what she would do in office. Do you have any sense at all, after this runoff campaign, about what Eric Garcetti will be like as mayor of Los Angeles?
Well, I've known Eric for a long time, and one thing, just to get back to the question you asked, which was what went wrong, I think a lot went right for Eric Garcetti, and I congratulate Bill and Eric and his team, ran a terrific campaign.
So the campaign's over. You're not going to pick up on my invitation to say that Eric Garcetti didn't really tell us much about what he was going to do.
No, listen, Eric is a brilliant guy. He's very smart. He's very capable. He's articulate. I think Bill and his team did a terrific job with Eric to highlight his strengths. And you know, but it's a difficult situation we're in as a city. And as a person who's married with four kids, and I'm a patriot of the city, I want Eric to do well. We're all invested in the success of the mayor. My hope is that at some point he'll sit down with Wendy and they'll get a chance to go through what was a pretty substantive 36-page plan to lead LA forward, dealing with pensions and balancing the budget and creating jobs. I'm sure they'll get a chance to sit down and talk about some of those ideas, some of which he may adopt, some of which he won't. But altogether, we're in this to try to make LA better.
Bill Carrick, Eric Garcetti occasionally talked about labor support, but basically that was what he beat Wendy Gruhl over the head with, was the independent campaign of the DWP, the Police Protective League, and other unions and union leaders. You would have thought that he had never talked to a labor union leader or taken a contribution. He tried to get the very support that she had from labor. How honest was it to make it appear that she was the labor candidate that he wasn't?
We never denied that we have strong ties to the labor movement. Never denied. We got a lot of union support. We had a tremendous support for across the board, Teamsters, food and commercial workers, CWA, UTLA. We had a lot of labor support. What we talked about was the role of the DWP. Union Super PAC and its outsized role in the campaign and what the consequences might be, but we never denied that Eric's not a strong supporter of labor and we had plenty of labor support.
So, John Chalman, how did that happen, and did the union support ultimately become something that was damaging to the campaign rather than something that was good for it?
Well, I think it did become damaging to the campaign. Wendy ran her first race successfully for council in the Valley and her second race for city controller. And she's always been perceived as sort of an outsider, a candidate who's independent. She appealed to moderates, to conservative voters in the San Fernando Valley. One of our challenges, of course, with Eric, who's very capable, progressive candidate, who traditionally did have labor support, we wanted to make sure we could cut him off from being able to get substantial resources and boots on the ground, which labor does provide. So we competed perhaps too well for union endorsements, and we were successful getting them. Of course, part of that success served to alienate some of our base support, and particularly the DWP union. The San Fernando Valley voters, starting with Measure B, probably before that, but with Measure B in particular, not very happy with the Department of Water and Power Union. They successfully were able to push back that Measure B. And so a lot of what the DWP union tends to touch in city elections, city council races, and now in the mayor's race, you get saddled with some of the negative impressions that voters have about the DWP union. And that's very difficult, as we saw in this race, to sort of escape from.
Bill Carrick, what does this mean for the future and labor support, not just for mayoral candidates, but for other city candidates as well? Is it going to be regarded as a liability rather than an asset?
Well, first of all, I mean, obviously labor's not monolithic. They separated, and many unions went with Eric, but the bulk of them did go with Wendy. I think we've seen in the last three competitive mayor's races that the labor-endorsed candidate has actually lost labor households. This time, the LMU poll, the Loyola Marymount poll, shows Eric won labor union households. So this is the third competitive race in a row where their endorsed candidate has lost their own members' households.
So, John Chalman, should you have anticipated that? Was there any way that you could mitigate the influence of your own support? Could she have called up the union and said, please, don't do this anymore?
Well, you can't communicate to a union or any IE that's participating in support for your candidacy. So it is very difficult. You're in a tough situation because, of course, there was a significant amount of money being spent to help Wendy. Of course, some voters who aren't as familiar with the campaign finance rules think that those dollars are going directly into our campaign coffers. Of course, they're not. So we can't control what they do, nor can we attempt to control what they would do. I think we have to sit down at some point with city leaders to talk about campaign finance rules that don't just benefit those who are receiving independent expenditures, but benefit those who are not receiving the independent expenditures to try to balance the field a little bit. I think it would perhaps create a situation where those who want to benefit a candidate might think twice about doing that if they know that public monies are going to come on the other side to help balance it. So I think we're going to talk about campaign finance reform, and I think that's really important for the future of LA.
Bill, let me ask you more about the candidates themselves, particularly about the Garcetti campaign. He was hard to pin down. I found that. I think a lot of other reporters did as well. And particularly,
Wait, which part of the 50 some odd debates did you miss, Warren? I mean, there was plenty of opportunity.
Every
one of these mayor's races has been like that. There are a lot. Every media outlet in town wants to have a sponsored debate. Every community group does. Every neighborhood council group.
But so, everyone tends to turn out just like every other one because the candidates say the same thing almost regardless of what questions they're asked.
Well, yeah, you know, that's, the skill, you know, you're a skilled moderator. You moderated one of the debates. You got people to talk about issues.
Sometimes.
Dave Bryan did a very good job with KCAL, KCBS. I think there were a number of moderators who were pretty good. There's some that weren't so good. But I think there was ample opportunity to hear every kind of specific thing you wanted to know from any of the candidates.
Well, but let me ask you this. It seems to me that neither one of them really addressed the financial condition of the city, and particularly the fact that even though the mayor, current mayor, has turned in a balanced budget, it is going to depend on union agreements to take cuts and pay for medical insurance. Did they create false expectations?
No, I think the reality is every one of the candidates talked in detail about what kind of financial crisis we're in. Economy's recovering somewhat. We're going to be better off in the short term, but I think every candidate felt like in the long term there were a lot of tough issues to deal with, and there's tough issues to deal with pensions and employee health care as well as salaries, and all of those things are going to have to be on the table in order to bring fiscal stability to the city.
John Shulman, what about the $160 million in waste that Ms. Gruhl touted as having found, which didn't seem to stand up to media scrutiny, and the claim that she was going to produce more police officers, 2,000 more police officers, which she sort of ultimately backed away from? Were those just mistakes?
No, I don't think so at all. First of all, I think there became a debate on semantics. More than what the numbers were. I think the Garcetti team did a very good job of sort of framing that Wendy Gruhl had only recovered a certain amount of money, $200,000 plus, and Wendy's $160 million number was about identifying waste. Much of it was gone already. Much of it had been wasted. Millions of dollars spent on gasoline that was stolen from the city. And so what she was focused on is presenting opportunities for the city council to adopt her audit report so they could in the future save more money. In terms of the 2,000 police officers, I've never seen a campaign impacted negatively by promoting more public safety officers. The issue came down to the Los Angeles Times suggesting that Wendy wasn't talking about realistic budget numbers. And of course, she was putting a plan out there. And I think one of our challenges in this campaign was that the Times and other media outlets didn't want to talk about the issues or the substance of the plan. And so it became much more in terms of process of stories, endorsements or mistakes, as opposed to really focusing on the issues. And so I don't think those are mistakes. And frankly, I think no one in LMU's poll would have walked out who voted for Eric Garcetti and said, well, I didn't vote for her because of that 2,000 cops plan. They didn't vote for those who were against her because they either liked Eric Garcetti or because they felt she was too tied to the DWP union, which ultimately became the central focus of the Garcetti media, rightly. They ran a very strong campaign. They write, very good ads to get their message through. But I'm pretty sure that that's what people were focused on in terms of the negatives of Wendy Gruhl.
Bill Carrick, how important is the LA Times in particular and the media in general in Los Angeles politics?
I think that, what we've seen is other than the governor's race and a mayor's race in LA and maybe San Francisco, there's very limited media coverage in political campaigns. There is a lot of media coverage in the L.A. mayor's race. There is a lot of TV coverage. There's a lot of coverage of the debates. There's a lot of coverage of the day-to-day. And I think the Times, as well as the Daily News and television stations, were pretty aggressive, much more so, and particularly in relative to the normal political coverage, which is almost non-existent now.
John Shulman, what's your opinion of the political coverage during this campaign?
I think it look, I mean, we're coming from a perspective. We had some grad students do some analyses of the number of stories written by the LA Times, of which there were close to 200, and they categorized them by those that were process-oriented versus those that were substantive. And it was gigantic discrepancy between those that focused on issues. I think we'd all be hard-pressed to sit back and say, when did they cover transportation, or when did they cover job creation, or when did they cover, you know, public safety or education? Most of the stories were about something negative related to the candidates, most of them Wendy. There were about 61 negative stories on Wendy Grewal, about 4 negative stories on Eric Garcetti. Now, I look at that not as someone who's saying the media did a bad job. They did a good job insofar as they put a lot of reporters on the race. They covered the race. And we had a lot of debates, probably too many debates from our perspective, because when you have a lot of debates, each of them become, I guess, less important individually, as opposed to having 3 or 4 well-publicized broadcast debates like the presidential campaigns are, where everyone gets a chance to see where there's substantial amounts of time being able to be spent on each issue. That would be something I would look forward to, hopefully, in future campaigns.
Bill Kerik, wasn't one of the reasons that there was a focus on process rather than substance because the candidates' records and the positions that were taking they were taking during the campaigns were so much the same?
Well, I don't know. That's the cliche. I mean, the truth is there were plenty of differences on issues. We obviously had a vigorous debate about the role of the controller in solving problems of waste, fraud, and abuse, went back and forth, was quite contentious. There was a lot of differences in the campaign. On this question of media coverage, I think the one thing you got to put in context is none of us control what the media does. I mean, those are decisions that are made somewhere else, and John's campaign did a great job. Wendy's campaign did a great job of getting endorsements early on. They had a lot of significant ones. Magic Johnson, Bill Clinton. By the end of it, I just couldn't imagine. I thought the Pope was going to come in and endorse her. I mean, they kept rolling out endorsements. So a lot of those process stories were generated by their campaign success in obtaining endorsements. I mean, what's the truth? Do we think Bill Clinton knows a lot about the intricacies of Los Angeles city government? No. It wasn't going to be a substantive story. It was going to be a character reference. I've worked with her. She did a great job when she worked for me. All of those became part of the media coverage. So the process thing doesn't bother me, particularly since both campaigns were out there trying to make a case that they had endorsements of people who were meaningful and are great references for why they should be mayor.
We're almost out of time. Bill Kerik, a very quick answer. When did you know you'd won?
I thought after the primary, I thought it was going to be very difficult for Wendy to come back and win. But I knew we were going to have a period of time where we had a little glow from the primary, and I knew it would get reengaged and would tighten up again. And I felt from the very beginning that we were in pretty good shape after the primary. Before the primary, I thought it was a real challenge. I thought it was a big challenge.
John Shulman, you're nodding. Obviously, Mr. Garcetti won the primary as well as the general.
He did. And
you knew?
Well, no. I mean, look, when we got our polling back right after the primary, it became clear to us in numbers, as I'm sure it did to Bill, that the vote that we had hoped to be part of our base, that Kevin James went out and Jan Perry went out and got, wasn't retrievable. And it's very difficult to get some of those redefine Wendy in a positive way when they've been pounded by $1 million of independent expenditure funding for Kevin James, telling people Wendy Grewal was not the person that thought that she was with DWP. And that was very harmful to us. Nonetheless, we felt really strong in the middle parts of this campaign. We've reset. We got great endorsements, as Bill said, started to go up on TV. The numbers moved. We at one point took a slight lead in the campaign, became a resource issue at that point. And they did a very effective job of making sure at the end they had their resources on TV, which closed the deal.
John Chalman, who ran the Wendy Grill campaign, Bill Carrick, who ran the campaign for Eric Garcetti. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
You're listening to Which Way LA from KCRW. Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/whichwayla or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter at WWLA.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. Last summer, three people died, six others became ill at Curry Village in Yosemite Valley. Visitors contracted the rare Hanta virus by inhaling dust contaminated with urine and saliva and fecal matter from infected deer mice. There were concerns about continued visitation to one of America's most beloved attractions. Now that Memorial Day weekend is over, here's Tom Medema, Chief of Interpretation and Education at Yosemite National Park. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Park Service has spent a lot of money to make sure this doesn't happen again. Tell us some of the things that have been done.
Yeah, this has been a three-pronged approach where we've done a lot of work, first of all, in exclusion, excluding rodents from buildings. So mice can fit into a hole the size of a pencil. So anything that's above a quarter of an inch, we have worked to caulk holes, to put screening over openings park-wide. And you could imagine in a park that's 150 years old with over 1,000 buildings, it's quite an undertaking to cover up all the holes of that size to keep the mice out. But that's what we've been doing. It's been very successful. We've also had an active trapping program where we've set over 18,000 traps since September, not only to test the mice, but also to minimize the number of mice in the areas that are populated by visitors. And then a robust education effort, starting with our park website, through our park newspapers, and in all of our lodging units, just to make sure people are aware of what hantavirus is. And we've had really good success with all of these things over the last 8 months, and there have been no further incidents since last summer.
Where does the hantavirus come from? Are you sure that if it doesn't attach itself to mice, that it won't infect some other animal that lives in the valley?
Yes, there's been no recorded cases of hantavirus being transmitted by any animals other than mice, particularly in Yosemite, deer mice in particular. It's not even all mice. It's just deer mice. Hmm. And so there's been no indication scientifically to date that it's transmitted from one animal to another and then to humans. So so far that hasn't been scientifically captured, and so we're assuming that we're safe from that.
You mentioned 150 years and 1,000 buildings. What about some of those tent cabins where the outbreak actually occurred? Were they in fact altered their construction?
Yeah. So the tent cabins where these cases in the valley took place were what they called Signature Series tent cabins, and they were a double wall tent cabin where we had insulated them with an interior drywall to heat them and make them better for wintertime users. And those were the units that were infected with hantavirus during that time. All of those 91 cabins have been removed, and they've been replaced by the traditional single wall tent cabin, which is the same type of tent cabin we've been using here for almost 100 years now. So there's some belief, although they haven't been able to prove it yet, but that double wall construction created a harborage space for mice, and that created a larger incidence of fecal and urine matter to be aerosolized and inhaled. So that's one of the theories. And so just to be safe, all 91 of those units were torn out and replaced with a traditional single wall unit, which don't have those same spaces for mice to harbor and to hide.
When three people died and others were made ill by hantavirus last summer, it was in the news. What did that do to reservations and visitation?
Yeah, well, there's no question that in the immediate aftermath, September, October, there was a considerable number of, there weren't a lot of cancellations, but at that point in time, we would have seen people reserving, you know, for May, June, and July. And what we saw was a drop off in the number of reservations being made for this spring and summer. And so that's created an unusual situation here in Yosemite, where, as you know, people line up, up to a year in advance to get these accommodations. And while all of our campgrounds are booked, as always, a number of the park lodging units, the hotel units and the tent cabins and things like that, still have some vacancy in advance. We're finding that they're filling up every night. So, you know, this weekend everything was full, and this week everything is full. So we're finding that those last-minute reservations, whereas in years past they would have strictly been out of luck, this year, because there was a little bit of lagging reservation time, those units are actually available more at the last minute. So we're still finding that we're full. We're still finding we have the same number of visitors that we had a year ago, but that those reservations aren't filling as quickly, but the rooms are still being used at the same rate, if that makes sense.
So it's a good year for procrastinators.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. It's very rare at this place that that's the case, but this is one of those years when you can get away with it.
How's the valley look? How are the falls?
It's really spectacular right now. We know with our second year of drought, we're a little bit past peak now. For the waterfalls, but I'm looking out my window at Upper Yosemite Fall right now, and it's still, in its full glory. Lots of people going up the Vernal and Nevada Fall Trail. The Merced River hasn't been getting too much visitation yet because it's been so cool. We've had really uncharacteristically cool temperatures. It's been delightful, in the 60s and 70s. We even had snow in Tuolumne Meadows over the weekend. So we've had some delightfully cool temperatures up here, and people are really getting out to enjoy it.
It has been a light snow year, though, as I understand it. Does that mean that the falls will dry up at any point?
It does. It means that we'll dry up earlier. 2 years ago when we had the major snowpack, we had Upper Yosemite Falls, which is purely snowmelt driven, that stayed watered throughout the entire year, which is rare. Mm-hmm. Last year, Upper Yosemite Falls, the falls dried up in July, and we expect this year again, and they'll dry up in July. So those coming in August and September, barring the occasional rainstorm that fills them up, they will dry a little bit earlier this year again as well.
All right. Well, I wish I, and I suspect our listeners, feel the same way, could look out the window and see those falls that you described.
Indeed.
In the meantime, Tom Medema at Yosemite National Park, Chief of Interpretation and Education, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.